Coon Review puts Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information @CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 14th of April from the news section. Artificial nests built in bid to help save golden eagles. This article is written by Jane MacLeod. A Scottish estate has built two new artificial golden eagle eyries in a bid to help restore a once thriving population of the birds. The Duke of Northumberland's Burncastle estate, near the Lammermuir Hills between East Lothian and the Borders, has worked on the nests with a pioneering charity project titled the South of Scotland Golden Eagle Project. As the project's first translocated birds begin to settle and reach breeding age, project managers believe artificial eyries will play a vital role in helping golden eagles re-establish even more territories in which they once thrived. The latest development follows a series of translocations by the project which, thanks to more than 17 privately owned estates, has increased the local population of golden eagles to 38, the highest number recorded for three centuries. Project manager Dr. Kat Barlow said, "Before the project's translocations began, we spent 11 years working with partners and raptor experts to identify a significant number of areas where they could do this. After so many years, it is fantastic to witness the eagles exploring long empty historical ranges. We're hoping these new artificial platforms will help the birds settle in areas we thought previously lost as nesting areas." The project's first two artificial eyries have been carefully placed by expert climbers high in the trees within the Burncastle estate. The team has deliberately selected secluded areas close to where three of the project's satellite-tagged golden eagles have been spotted. Welcoming the development, project partner Pip Tabor of the Southern Uplands Partnership said, "Working with local people, communities, businesses and estates to make sustainable use of our natural and cultural heritage is at the very heart of all that we do at the Southern Uplands Partnership. It's fantastic to see the approach being embraced by estates like Burncastle, who've truly taken the birds under their wings and gone above and beyond to help this iconic bird soar in the Southern Uplands once again." NatureScot Chief Executive Francesca Osaska added, "We're committed to protecting and restoring nature across Scotland, so we're delighted that estates like Burncastle are working with the groundbreaking South of Scotland Golden Eagle Project. Golden eagles are a vital part of Scotland's wildlife, and it's brilliant to see so many people and organisations working together to bring them back to the areas where they used to thrive." That article was written by Jane MacLeod. This is from The National on Friday the 14th of April from the politics section. DWP errors contributed to people's deaths, damning report finds. This article is written by Xander Eliards. Issues and errors in the UK government's benefits assessments have contributed to the deaths of claimants, a damning report has found. MPs on the Work and Pensions Committee, which has a Conservative majority, said they were deeply concerned about the issue in a report looking at the Department for Work and Pensions health assessments. "These assessments help inform decisions on a range of benefits, but issues have persisted for years." The committee's report published on Friday, said, "Our predecessor committee found in its 2018 inquiry that there were significant problems with these assessments. We found many of these remain, despite some improvements." Important changes to improve trust and transparency have not been made, and the system continues to let down some of the often vulnerable people who rely on it. It goes on, "We were deeply concerned that nearly 5 years after our predecessor's report, people are still experiencing psychological distress as a result of undergoing health assessments. In some cases, issues or errors in the system are associated with or have been found at the coroner's inquest to have contributed to the deaths of claimants." As an example, MPs pointed to the case of Errol Graham, who starved to death after his benefit payments were stopped, having lost a legal challenge against the DWP. His daughter-in-law, Alison Turner, said at the time, "He'd stopped going out or answering calls because he could no longer bring himself to deal with people, which is pretty much the number one classic sign of mental health deterioration. Yet no one at the DWP bothered to red flag that something serious may be wrong. There was no duty of care. He didn't reply, so he was crossed off their books." David Linden, the SNP social justice spokesperson at Westminster, said, "People had paid the ultimate price for the Tories' failure to act." He said, "5 years ago, the Tories were warned by this very committee that the DWP's health assessment system required urgent change. They didn't act, and now some claimants have paid the ultimate price. This is a scandalous revelation which lies squarely with the Tories. However, we have sadly become accustomed to this. The sanction regime introduced by this Tory government has plunged millions of families into poverty, forcing many to remain on universal credit and take lower paid jobs." In contrast, under a progressive SNP government, people in Scotland enjoy a social security system that is built on fairness, dignity and respect, and provides a safety net for those on the lowest income. And all this is achieved with one hand tied behind our back. With the full powers of a normal, independent country, we could revolutionise the benefit system in Scotland and finally build a fairer, more equal Scotland and eradicate poverty once and for all. The MP's report said that the UK government should ensure that young people in receipt of disability living allowance should not be required to claim PIP, that's personal independence payment, until they are 18, as is the case in Scotland. It further said, "We were very interested to hear from the Scottish Government and Social Security Scotland about plans for the adult disability payment, which is replacing PIP. This is likely to provide a good test of whether problems with PIP are in its policy framework or its implementation. We look forward to seeing its evaluation and urge the Department to watch this process closely and consider what changes, if any, it should make following this." That article was written by Zander Eliards. This is from The National on Friday the 14th of April from the Politics section. Yousaf says it would have been helpful to know about SNP finances. This article is written by Gregor Young. Humza Yousaf has said it would have been helpful to know about the SNP's issues with auditors before becoming First Minister. Speaking to Sky News during a visit to a school in Glasgow on Thursday, the First Minister discussed the ongoing financial challenges facing the party. It emerged this week that auditors Johnston Carmichael had resigned around 6 months ago, with SNP members not being informed. The party is on the hunt to find a replacement firm before a July deadline. It is also dealing with the arrest and subsequent release of former CEO and Nicola Sturgeon's husband, Peter Morrell, in a police investigation into the SNP's financial affairs. I, of course, only knew about the auditors resigning when I became party leader, Youssef told journalists on Thursday morning. One of my first instructions to the party has been to make sure we get replacement auditors. But I'm going to do my best, and we're going to do our best as a party to meet it. Youssef was asked if it was wrong that he was left in the dark on the auditor situation prior to being elected as SNP leader last month. Well, look, I think people have got a very reasonable question to ask the party around transparency. That's why I've committed to a review of governance and transparency with external input, he said. Frankly, it would have been helpful to have known beforehand. But equally, I know the party has been working to try to get replacement auditors, without success so far. My job is to make sure we can get those replacement auditors as soon as I possibly can. Youssef also confirmed he would look into the publishing of the resignation letter from the party's former auditor. I'll be happy to look at that, but of course, we'd have to get the permission of Johnston Carmichael, he said. On Wednesday night, The National revealed that one member of the SNP's governing body is threatening to quit if forensic accountants are not brought in. Bill Ramsey, the convener of the SNP trade union group, TUG, said he had been warning about a lack of transparency for some time. If the call to appoint forensic auditors is not moved forward, I will have to seriously consider whether I can continue on the NEC, he warned. That article was written by Gregor Young.
From The National, Monday 17th of April 2023, from the politics section, Sir Alok Sharma, former minister denies bullying allegations. Report by Adam Robertson. A former Tory cabinet minister has denied allegations that he bullied civil servants. Sir Alok Sharma, who is president of the COP26 climate summit, said he had never been aware of any complaints against him. He was alleged to have been difficult to work with, insulting staff's work and using expletives, Bloomberg reported, citing four senior officials. Sharma was also said to have bullied junior civil servants by calling them out of the blue to disparage their work during the pandemic, with the allegations spanning his time as business secretary and his climate change presidency from 2020 to 2022. It was reported that concerns about Sharma's behaviour were raised with civil service bosses at least four times in 2020, although there were not official complaints. It comes as Rishi Sunak's deputy Dominic Raab is under investigation over eight formal complaints about his behaviour. The Prime Minister, who pledged to uphold integrity, professionalism and accountability in government, is bracing for the probe led by senior lawyer Adam Tolley QC into Raab's conduct during stints in three departments to conclude. Raab, who is also Justice Secretary, has insisted he is not a bully. In response to the allegations against Sharma, a government spokesperson said, "We have no records of any complaints." Sharma, now a Tory backbencher, said, "I have never been made aware of any informal complaints or otherwise from staff. The Cabinet Office has confirmed there are no records of any informal or formal complaints across government about me. I refute strongly these allegations. I have worked with hundreds of officials as a government minister, and I always felt I maintained a good relationship with them, exemplified by seven of my BEIS private office team, those officials working most closely with me, choosing to join my COP private office alongside those I had worked with in previous ministerial roles." The PA News agency understands that calls made by Sharma to staff were during work hours, with the allegation regarded as weak among some in Whitehall, where he's said to enjoy a good reputation. Sharma lost his seat around the cabinet table in Sunak's reshuffle upon entering number 10 in October. The Reading West MP is expected to be in Boris Johnson's resignations honours list. And that report was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Monday the 17th of April 2023, from the news section, Tayside tackles challenge of feeding Scotland through climate crisis, by Ruth Watson, founder of the Keep Scotland the Brand campaign. Life can feel a bit overwhelming these days. Food prices are soaring, supermarket shelves are often empty, wildlife is disappearing at a dangerous rate, and we see the evidence of climate change around us, with wildfires, droughts and violent spring storms. Meanwhile, the farmers we rely on to provide our food are being hit with a series of whammies. Growing conditions are more unpredictable. Finding skilled labour is difficult, expensive or impossible, leading to crops rotting in fields. Fuel, feed and fertiliser costs are spiralling higher. The supermarkets, determined to keep their grip on shareholder profits, are squeezing what they pay producers. Many farmers are giving up, resulting in food shortages and price rises. The recent lack of eggs was predicted last August. I am a strong advocate for clear provenance. I believe every one of Scotland's people should be able to enjoy the terrific produce our farmers deliver, and I really care about our natural world. So, when Bioregioning Tayside asked if I would help them explore ways to support sustainability and get local food onto local plates, my answer was an immediate yes. A bioregion is an area defined by its natural features rather than the lines people draw on maps. Dr. Pete Iannetta, agroecologist with the James Hutton Institute and part of the Bioregion Tayside Working Group, explains more. Using a bioregioning approach helps us develop a management plan for social, economic and ecological sustainability. We know the current food system is not protecting the world, our natural environment, the people who use it or the farmers who provide the food. A bioregion approach pulls these things together. Things became even more interesting when the Bioregioning Tayside suggested we use something called social tipping point methodology, a remarkably simple and positive idea from the enthusiastic Dr. Arvid Boelmark of Sweden's Karlstad University. Boelmark says, I believe the problem of climate change has to be solved by bottom-up community-scale efforts. Social tipping points through intervening at the climate action sweet spot can generate diverse community-scale climate action projects. Tayside is the first bioregion to which I brought the concept of social tipping points, and they saw the value of adopting this in their transformation process. Tayside is also unique in the sense that it's the first bioregion aiming to become the climate action sweet spot by consolidating and scaling up diverse community efforts to reach the goals of the Paris Agreement. And so it was that almost 100 people with a widely diverse range of perspectives, professions and experiences ended up in Dundee's Discovery Point at the end of March, eating the best macaroni cheese pies I've ever tasted, cooked fresh by Nicole's Rosebank Bakery. They discussed feeding Tayside through the climate crisis with leading food and drink professionals, community growers, farmers, food banks, Cabinet Secretary Marie Gougeon, teachers, students, RSABI, the Mental Wellbeing Charity for Agricultural Workers, environmentalists, procurement specialists and more, all working together to come up with a meaningful way ahead. The day was electric, said Claire Cooper, co-initiator of Bioregioning Tayside. The energy in the room was astonishing. Everyone was up for the challenge. There was a real sense of urgency, impetus and goodwill. Those with differing views were chatting to find ways to move forward together, to drive the urgent action we need to survive climate change and biodiversity collapse. Many issues were identified on the day, among them a lack of local infrastructure and processing, a dearth of markets selling fresh local produce in the heart of communities, and the potential to feed our school children freshly cooked, tasty local produce grown using regenerative methods. While councils in Tayside have not yet signed up to the Food for Life Served Here scheme, Dr. Kevin Frediani, curator of the University of Dundee Botanic Garden, sees this as a significant opportunity. Procurement has huge potential to provide our food producers with a stable financial basis to develop a more sustainable model while feeding our children the best we have to offer. A just transition is crucial. We need to reassess the value of good food in our communities, the impact that has on the NHS, for example. Working with bioregional approach helps us to understand the link between our social system and the ecosystem. Work is now being done to bring together the diverse ideas and views from the day, to embed a commitment to local food and drink across Tayside, for people, producers and planet, taking the first steps towards creating the social tipping point needed for positive change. And that article was an exclusive written by Ruth Watson, who is the founder of the Keep the Scotland the Brand campaign. From the National, Monday the 17th of April 2023, from the comment section, Scotland needs to reckon with its sentencing around sexual violence. Report by Kirsty Strickland. Why did the person walk out of court a free man? My life has been ruined. That question, posed by the victim of Sean Hogg, is one that has been asked by many since he was found guilty of raping her when she was 13. In an interview with the Sunday Mail, the victim, now 18, spoke of her distress that rapist Hogg was spared jail and given a pitiful 270 hours of community work for the series of attacks he perpetrated upon her. The sentence handed down by the judge was criticised for being unduly lenient and for the emphasis it placed on the fact that Hogg was 17 at the time of the offence and that he was a first-time offender. What kind of message does that send to victims and perpetrators of rape? There are certain types of crimes that are of such seriousness that they should be exempt from any leniencies in sentencing due to it being a first-time offence. It is grotesque that any rapist is given what amounts to a pass for their first offence. Rape isn't a mistake or an accident. It isn't something that just happens or something that can be excused away because perpetrators didn't think through the harm it would cause. In whatever circumstances it occurs, it is an act rooted in power and control. Rape is a conscious, deliberate choice an abusive man makes. As a society, we're often far too quick to minimise that choice or allow excuses for it. It is an inherently destructive act and its impact on the victim is long-lasting. Yet sexual violence is one of the lowest conviction rates of any crime in Scotland. When victims do manage to navigate the difficult and often traumatic process of getting to court, they are still being let down by a system that is stacked against them. Imagine how it must feel to hear your rapist's age, previous good conduct and employment prospects used to minimise the horror of what he did to you. In the interview with the Sunday Mail, Hogg's teenage victim posed a vital question. Why was he allowed to get on with his life when he's clearly ruined mine? During sentencing, the judge said he didn't believe that sending Hogg to prison would contribute to his rehabilitation. But rehabilitation surely shouldn't be the only consideration. What about punishment? What about safeguarding? What about deterring other would-be perpetrators? As a society, our words around sexual violence don't often match our actions. We say that it is a terrible crime. The judge himself said during sentencing that rape was one of the most serious crimes, yet we have built a system that routinely lets victims down and perpetrators off. While much has been made of Hogg's age at the time of the offence being a mitigating factor, the judge said that he had been over 25 at the time. He would still have been likely to only serve 4 or 5 years. Hogg's victim says that she now wonders, why did I even bother reporting the rape in the first place? Nothing happened and 3 years on the sex offender's register for a serial sex offender adds to the insult of what he did to me. The Crown Office is currently considering whether there are grounds for lodging an appeal against the sentence. Rape Crisis Scotland Chief Executive Sandy Brindley said, it is hard to think of any circumstances where community service for rape could ever be an appropriate sentence. It is also extremely difficult to see how this could in any way act as rehabilitation for rape. It takes tremendous courage for any woman to report rape. It is also completely understandable why so many do not. The victim in this case was just 13 years old at the time the offences took place. There is no doubt that she had been let down by the system she should have been able to rely on to seek some sort of justice. The path to what ended us in a sentence of a paltry 270 hours of community service was a long one for the victim. It would have involved many, many hours of interviews, statements, appointments and appearances, all of which can be re-traumatising for victims and survivors of sexual violence. Hogg's crimes and the lost process for seeking justice for them swallowed up what should have been formative, fun teenage years and, as the victim puts it, it looks like it was for nothing. She deserves so much better. As do all victims of sexual violence whose life's prospects and well-being have been placed secondary to the abusive men that perpetrate them. And that was a comment piece by Kirsty Strickland. From the National, Monday the 17th of April 2023, in the comment section. The BBC is determined to paint our picture of enthusiastic royalists. An article by Graham Smith, Republic Chief Executive. A YouGov poll out last week showed that more than 60% of people do not care much about the coronation and just 9% care a great deal. Another YouGov poll conducted 2 weeks earlier showed only 15% were very interested. With no more than 15% enthusiastic about the forthcoming parade, you might think the media would be reflecting on why this is and what it means for the future of the monarchy. It might be reasonable to expect the indifferent and those opposed to the monarchy to have their views widely expressed to their national broadcasters, particularly the BBC. You might also expect the BBC to step back to deliver coverage which is entirely impartial and independent. Yet, if you watch the BBC's coverage of the coronation, it carries on regardless, determined to paint a picture of a nation of enthusiastic royalists gearing up for a national celebration. Over recent weeks, I've had BBC producers on the phone saying they want to show that not everyone is celebrating. When I point out that their framing of the question is back to front, that those not celebrating are in the majority, a point which should be reflected in the report, they go quiet and I don't hear back from them. Support for the abolition of the monarchy is now over 30%, up from a typical 20% in previous years. Yet, inclusion of Republican voices remains an afterthought, a last-minute attempt at balance. At the time of the Jubilee last year, the BBC's website carried more than 400 celebratory stories and just one about the Republican opposition, which led with criticism of Republic's campaign. So far, its coverage of the coronation shows all signs of business as usual. A culture of deference towards the monarchy appears to be hardwired into the BBC, and it's time that it changed. I've written to David Jordan, the BBC's Director of Editorial and Policy Standards, strongly condemning its royal coverage. I met Jordan 12 years ago after we wrote to him criticising coverage of the 2011 royal wedding. The BBC promised to achieve balance over time. More than a decade later, we're still waiting. Yet it's not just a matter of balance, but one of impartiality. Not every royal story needs a Republican voice, but, at all times, the BBC must report with impartiality and detachment. With royal reporting, it fails spectacularly. Part of the problem is the sheer volume of royal coverage, reporting in every trivial detail of the coronation and the comments and engagements of the royals, regardless of legitimate news value. And that coverage is entirely sympathetic. The BBC barely made mention of protests at recent engagements, such as the Commonwealth Day service at Westminster Abbey last month. Instead, it reported the King's speech at length without any critical assessment of what he said. The same was true of the King's attendance in the Monday service in York, playing down opposition and focusing on promoting the line issued by the Palace press operation. All broadcasters routinely make use of so-called royal experts, who are almost all royalists, and have always put on the most positive spin on their questionable analysis. As often as not, that analysis is nothing more than speculation and wishful thinking, and, when it comes to the more serious issues such as charges of royal corruption, funding and the role of the monarchy in our constitution, they're usually out of their depth. Very rarely the BBC invites more impartial or thoughtful analyses. Where royalist commentators are introduced as experts, implying their views hold a certain value, this isn't the case with Republican commentators. BBC collusion with the palace is commonplace. David Dimbleby, speaking late last year, said that during the coverage of the Queen's funeral, the palace was sending minute-by-minute instructions to the BBC on what footage could be reused. This is a direct attack on the independence of our national broadcaster, but, as ever, the BBC rolled over and complied. The result of this collusion and complicity in promoting the monarchy is that the BBC does not hold the monarchy or the monarch to account. It does not accurately reflect public opinion. It routinely misleads the public and misrepresents the issue, and they exclude the views of millions of people around the UK. Given that Republicans and those who are largely indifferent are apathetic, when combined, form a clear majority in the country, the result of the BBC's coverage is to serve the interests of a shrinking minority, around 15%, who could reasonably be called royalists. In doing so, they do a disservice to the whole nation. I put the BBC's failures down to cultural bias and the lack of awareness rather than conspiracy, but they are determined and conscious efforts on the part of some to ensure the BBC sails the royal line, not least from the palace itself. That they attempt to control and manipulate our national broadcaster speaks volumes about the monarchy and how vulnerable to criticism they are. That the BBC allows itself to be used and manipulated by the palace speaks to a wider failure in the corporation, one that needs to be addressed with some urgency. Graham Smith's new book, Abolish the Monarchy, Why We Should and How We Will, is out on June the 1st. And that was a comment piece by Graham Smith. From The National, Monday the 17th of April 2023, from the Culture section, Holly Willoughby to miss ITV's This Morning due to shingles. Report by Patrick Glover. Holly Willoughby will be absent from her usual presenting role on ITV's This Morning this week due to a bout of shingles. Willoughby posted a message on Instagram last night revealing the news. In a story post, she said, "Hi, just to let you know I may be away for the rest of the week as I have shingles. Be back as soon as I'm better. Huge love, Holly, XXX." Fans took to social media to show their support for Willoughby following the news. One fan said, "At Holly Willoughby, get well soon." While another person said, "I want to pass on my huge get well message to at Holly Willoughby and hope she recovers from her surprising illness of having shingles." What is shingles? Shingles, according to the NHS, is an infection that causes a painful rash. The NHS website says initial signs of shingles include a tingling or painful feeling in an area of skin, a headache or generally feeling unwell, and a rash will appear a few days later. The website adds, "Usually you get shingles rash in your chest and tummy, but it can appear anywhere in your body, including on your face, eyes and genitals. The rash appears as it blotches your skin on one side of your body only. A rash on both the left and right side of your body is unlikely to be shingles. For advice on shingles, call the NHS on 111. Who will replace Holly Willoughby on This Morning? Willoughby will this week be replaced by Rochelle Humes. Humes will be joining the returning Philip Schofield, who has been on leave from the show since before Easter. The news of Schofield's return was mixed emotions by fans, with some not happy to see him back on TV after his brother was found guilty of abusing a teenage boy over a period of 3 years. On Instagram, one person said, "Why is he back?" While another added, "I'll not be watching anymore. Very disappointing he's back on TV." A third person said, "Bring back Alison and Dermot." Some were more pleased to see the return of the regular This Morning host. One supporter said, "Bring him back. I think the whole team is great together. Let's all be kind." While another said, "Welcome back, Philip, and get well soon, Holly. Love Rochelle as well. Looking forward to watching." And that report was by Patrick Glover.
From The National, Tuesday the 18th of April, 2023, from the news section. Rare Whiskey, chosen by Doddy Weir, released to raise funds for MND, by Steph Braun. A whiskey, specially selected by the late Doddy Weir, is set to be released to raise funds for the My Name's Doddy Foundation. The Highland Single Malt, distilled and bottled by Ardnamurchan Distillery, was chosen from a single ex Oloroso sherry cask dated June the 9th, 2017, for the Scottish rugby legend, and will be on sale from Wednesday. The 61-cap Scotland International was accompanied by friends and fellow rugby legends, including former Scotland captain Rob Wainwright, Irish great Keith Wood, and Scotland scrum half Gary Armstrong, when he visited the distillery in Glenbeg shortly before he died to pick the final cask. Weir died on November the 26th last year after almost 6 years living with MND. Others making the trip included close friend of Weir and ex-Scotland player Carl Hogg. A total of 327 bottles have been labelled specially to support the My Name's Doddy Foundation's fundraising efforts. Four bottles, numbers 1, 2, 5 and 55, will be kept aside for future action to raise funds for the charity. The release will be sold via Scotland's leading specialist whisky retailer, Royal Mile Whiskies, with all profits donated to the charity. Wainwright, who has helped to raise millions for the My Name's Doddy Foundation, said, "Doddy loved a dram, and it was very poignant to get the group back together for the trip to Col and Ardnamurchan to select the final whisky with him. We didn't know it then, but it was one of the last times many of us would spend with him. Doddy's legacy runs through the foundation and the continued mission to find a cure for MND, and it's fair to say there's a drop of it in every bottle of this special whisky. Bottled at 59.2 ABV, it has a colour of old oak and toffee lights. On the nose there is sweet and salted toffee, sea spray, chocolate-coated raisins and a hint of banoffee. The palate is said to be mouth-coating with hazelnut praline, sea salt and bonfire embers, with a finish of lingering milk chocolate." Alex Bruce, managing director at Ardnamurchan Distillery, said, "We were incredibly honoured to welcome Doddy to our wee distillery at the beginning of October last year. His enthusiasm for life was unmatched, and I hope that everyone who manages to grab a bottle from this cask raises a dram in his honour. We look forward to donations from the sale of these limited edition bottles of whisky, raising more funds to support the continued efforts to find a cure for motor neuron disease." Paul Thompson, director of fundraising at My Name's Doddy Foundation, added, "It's particularly special to see the cask Doddy hand-selected just before he died, now packaged in these beautiful bottles featuring the My Name's Doddy tartan. We are confident the AD/0617 cask will be highly sought after and raise a significant amount of our fundraising efforts and will support our search for a cure to motor neuron disease." Since the launch of Doddy Aid 2023, more than £2 million has been raised by fundraisers for the charity. Around 40,000 people, including Lewis Capaldi and Ewan McGregor, took part in this year's Doddy Aid, a six-week challenge made up of running, rowing and riding, which takes place over the first 6 weeks of every year from January the 1st. This article was by Steph Braun.
From The National, of Tuesday the 18th of April 2023. From the comment section, Karen Adam: Scotland has fertile soil for innovation. Let's act. Ask yourselves this: what really matters to you in your life? What do you value in the communities that you live in? What kind of country and society do we really want to be? Former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon asked these questions at a TED Global talk a few years ago. She told the audience at the Edinburgh International Conference Centre, "When we engage people in those questions and finding the answers to those questions, then I believe that we have a much better chance of addressing the alienation and disaffection from politics that is so prevalent in so many countries across the developed world today." I've been pondering those questions a great deal lately. As multiple crises continue their grip on much of the world, Sturgeon's call for a focus on the broader measurements of health and well-being as a gauge of our country's success, rather than our wealth or gross domestic product, has never been more fitting. When we focus on well-being and make the happiness of Scotland's people our guiding principle, we give hope to so many who are plagued by apathy to politics. We inspire a generation who otherwise do not trust the ballot box to solve their problems. Our country has experienced great upheavals in recent years, and in these times of turbulence, our well-being has found renewed importance, and we have put in perspective those who are essential to our well-being. If the pandemic and associated lockdowns taught us anything, it is that our well-being depends fundamentally on a healthy and active society full of citizens who are well-educated, skilled and able to contribute to society. Without our healthcare workers and our teachers, this would not be possible. It's testament to First Minister Hamza Yousaf's ability that he was responsible for Scotland being the only nation across the UK to stave off industrial strike action in our NHS. Communities which are inclusive and empowered, resilient and safe, are vital to a well-being economy, and the role of social enterprises and charities in this regard cannot be overstated. It has been my privilege during parliamentary recess to spend time with some of those doing great work in the North East. One of the many gems Banff has to offer is Vanilla Ink the Smiddy, an incredible social enterprise offering silversmithing and jewellery opportunities to many, including disadvantaged young people and neurodiverse people. The North East is a powerhouse for Scotland's well-being. So many of our national outcomes will depend on us. In Scotland, we are blessed with an abundant natural resources and the infrastructure to make use of them. It is vital, however, that we protect these assets for future generations to inherit. Their way of life and well-being depend on it. Much of my work in Parliament lately has been focused on the impact of the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis on our country. In the North East, we are already seeing the alarming impacts of these twin crises. We are hit hardest by storms, rising tides and coastal erosion. Acres of forestry have been lost across my constituency as a result of never-before-seen gale-force winds. And the migration of cod and urban gulls has had a notable impact on the lives and livelihoods of my constituents. And while many recognise we have a climate emergency, not all of us know that we face a nature emergency too. Professor Des Thompson, Principal Advisor on Biodiversity and Science at Nature Scot, told me at the Rural Affairs and Islands Committee that while, quotes, there is a growing realisation of the nature emergency, we've got a long way to go. He told me, what happened with gulls is a catastrophe, but it's because of what's happened at sea. The food base for gulls has declined for a great many reasons, so gulls have had to move inland. So they're moving into towns and cities not adapted to breeding. Gulls are now very good at tracking school children where they know there will be ready food for them. What we're seeing with gulls is just a symptom of climate change. The broader realisation of climate change contributing to the nature crisis and therefore the problems we have on our doorstep cannot be overstated, and our agricultural workers, more so than anyone else, get it. They are witnessing these changes in real time and understand the changes that are taking place. Sustainable and regenerative farming is at the heart of the Scottish Government's vision for agriculture, and rightly so. The twin biodiversity and climate crises are existential. They will present challenges and opportunities for Scotland's farmers and crofters, and if we are to ensure that there are fewer of the former and more of the latter in the years and decades to come, it is vital that we act with our climate targets and net zero ambitions in mind. Agriculture makes up around one quarter of Scotland's greenhouse gas emissions. Throughout history, Scotland has been fertile soil for innovation. And our transition to net zero building infrastructure that is resilient to the twin climate and biodiversity crises and the safeguarding of our food security all depend on innovation. In recent years, we have witnessed many disruptions to global food supply chains, most recently with Russia's abhorrent war in Ukraine. The COVID pandemic posed some very real challenges to the global food system. And while those impacts were not unique to Scotland, those caused by the hard Brexit imposed on Scotland were entirely avoidable. The UK government has done immense and irreversible damage to our world-class food and drinks industries and to rural and coastal communities such as the one I represent, and it's affecting the well-being, present and future, of our young people. At the Young Scots for Independence inaugural international conference this weekend, I heard firsthand the severe impact it is having on the education and prospects of the next generation. As the UK government turns its attention to curtailing our diplomatic efforts overseas, Scotland must ask itself another existential question. Does it want to be held back by Brexit Britain or flourish as an independent European nation? On this question, at least, my mind is made up. This article was by Karen Adam from The National of Tuesday, the 18th of April 2023, from the comment section. The truth about cannabis is clear if you see through UK smokescreen, by Ellie Gomersall. This Thursday is April the 20th, known around the world as 420 Day, a day when cannabis users celebrate its use and in countries where it is yet to be decriminalised, campaign for its decriminalisation. Scotland is one of these countries, with the failed Misuse of Drugs Act 1971 being reserved to Westminster, meaning Scotland is tied to the UK's regressive approach to drugs. The UK currently considers cannabis to be a Class B substance alongside the likes of ketamine and codeine, meaning even just possession could result in a prison sentence of up to 5 years and a fine of £2,500. Growing or dealing can result in a prison sentence of 14 years. While many countries around the country are changing their drug laws to be more progressive, the Tories are, as per usual, dragging us backwards. In October 2022, it emerged that Home Secretary Suella Braverman wanted to reclassify cannabis as a Class A substance, placing it alongside heroin and cocaine in the highest category and bringing sentences of up to 7 years for possession and life imprisonment for supplying. While Hamza Yousaf, who was Health Secretary at the time, condemned these comments, a recent speech by Keir Starmer only went to show that a Labour government in Westminster would be no less regressive when it comes to drug policy than the current Conservative one. In a speech on crime last month, the hopeful future Prime Minister told journalists that the smell of cannabis smoke entering the homes of his constituents was ruining their lives. What a load of nonsense. While the smell of weed is hardly pleasant, the notion that it is ruining lives is not only laughable, it's dangerous. What has ruined people's lives? The UK's failed war on drugs. Cannabis is a drug that around 30% of adults in England and Wales have used at least once, and although comparative figures for Scotland aren't available, it's likely that the rate is similar north of the border. It's a commonly used and relatively safe drug, significantly safer than alcohol and tobacco, and the majority of health complications resulting from its consumption are related to either the tobacco content when smoked or impurities as a result of dodgy dealers. In fact, the vast majority of harm caused by cannabis is caused by its illegality as opposed to the drug itself. The fact that it's illegal means there's no regulation and therefore no scrutiny of dealers and the purity of what they're producing and selling. Health issues caused by contaminants can be far more dangerous than those caused by cannabis itself, and there's no incentive for dealers to produce a high-quality, safe product if they can cut corners to maximise profit. Likewise, crime breeds crime, and the fact that the production and sale of cannabis must take place behind closed doors makes other crimes far more likely. A number of studies in the US have found that the legalisation or decriminalisation of cannabis results in a significant decrease in violent and organised crime. Decriminalisation would also relieve a huge amount of pressure on the criminal justice system. According to 2017 research by the Lib Dems, police spent on average more than 1 million hours per year enforcing its prohibition across the UK. Research also clearly shows that people of colour are far more likely to be stopped and searched by police on suspicion of possession, further demonstrating the systemic racism at the heart of the war on drugs. All the evidence suggests that decriminalisation of cannabis is the common sense approach and would be a welcome move towards treating drug use as a public health issue rather than a criminal one. This is the approach taken by a number of countries over the past few years, including Canada, Portugal and some US states. Portugal decriminalised the use of all drugs in 2001, and in the 20 years since, drug use levels have remained consistently below the EU average, as well as seeing significant drops in overdoses and drug-related crime. Portugal's approach is clearly working, while UK's war on drugs has clearly failed. The Lib Dems, SNP and Scottish Greens all support decriminalisation, and a 2019 report by the Westminster Scottish Affairs Committee made clear recommendations in support of it. But with drug policy reserved to the UK government, Scotland's hands are tied. Just last year, the government of Bermuda, a British overseas territory in the North Atlantic, passed a bill to decriminalise cannabis as a key commitment of the Progressive Labour Party, which was overwhelmingly elected in 2020. Despite this significant support from the public and Bermuda's democratically elected government, the UK government blocked the bill from receiving royal assent in a move which sounds all too familiar to those of us here in Scotland. The Scottish Government has used its limited powers to make some progressive moves, such as the 2021 announcement by the Lord Advocate that those found to be in possession of drugs of any class can be issued a recorded warning rather than automatic prosecution. This is also hugely important for those who use cannabis for medical purposes. Although medicinal cannabis has been legalised in the UK, it can only be prescribed under very specific circumstances, forcing many to turn to the black market to get the basic medicine they need. The Conservatives and Labour are both clearly attached to a policy that just doesn't work. One which criminalises and stigmatises innocent people and unnecessarily burdens our health and justice systems. The SNP and Greens have repeatedly called on the UK to devolve drug laws to Holyrood, but Westminster would much rather hoard the power for themselves and continue down this destructive path, allowing ordinary people to suffer as a result. It couldn't be clearer. The Misuse of Drugs Act has fundamentally failed and has caused far more harm than the smell of cannabis ever could. This article was by Ellie Gomersall.
The National News on Wednesday, the 19th of April. Community-owned library opens its doors. An article written by Jane McLeod. Village residents have hailed the opening of the first community-owned library to be built in Scotland for generations. the Thomas Graham Library, a partnership between the local community in Strathblane and Stirling Council, is part of a £1 million hub facility that also includes meeting and social facilities. It's been largely funded by crowdfunding after almost 300 families and local businessman Angus Graham invested in the project. Mr. Graham officially opened the new building yesterday, which was named after his great-uncle, a 19th century chemistry professor. Councillor Jerry McGarvey, convener of Stirling Council's Community Wellbeing and Housing Committee, said, "This groundbreaking partnership has resulted in the first community-owned public library to be built in Scotland in living memory. Local government finances are facing a time of constraint, but this innovative collaboration between the council and the local community provides a solution that gives our libraries a bright future. It's a testimony to our joint commitment to learning and partnership work that we've such a wonderful resource now freely available to all in the Strathblane community." First through the doors were the library's oldest member, Angus Lyness, who is 95, and one of its youngest members, Rory Balfour, aged 3, together with children from the adjacent Strathblane Primary School. Margaret Vass, chair of Strathblane Community Development Trust, which organised the fundraising as well as the building's design and construction, said, "I still can't really believe we've done this. It's the biggest thing we've had happen in this village for at least 40 years. Now we have this state-of-the-art building for everyone to use and enjoy." An article written by Jane McLeod. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 19th of April. Labour deputy leader makes direct appeal to SNP voters, but ducks the referendum question. An article written by Judith Duffy. Labour's deputy leader has appealed to SNP voters for backing at the next election, but refused to say if her party would ever agree to an independence referendum. In a speech at the STUC's annual Congress, Angela Rayner said that she wanted to make a direct appeal to people who have voted SNP in the past, saying she shared the desire to get rid of the Tories. But when questioned on whether Labour would give a Section 30 order if asked by First Minister Humza Yousaf, she said that that was not for me to decide. And asked if there were any circumstances in which her party would agree to another independence vote, Ms. Rayner said it was not a priority for people who were exhausted by referendums. In her speech, Ms. Rayner told STUC delegates gathered in Dundee, "More than ever, we need politicians actually focused on delivering change. It starts with recognising we can only make a better Scotland for workers by making an economy that works for the people of Aberdeen, Angus, Ayr, as well as it does for my community in Ashton-under-Lyme in Greater Manchester. And so I want to make a direct appeal to people who have voted SNP in the past. I totally understand your desire for change. I share it. I recognise your desire to get rid of the Tories. I share it. I know you dream of a brighter future. It's a dream that both me and Keir share." Speaking to the media afterwards, Ms. Rayner said Labour planned to break the dominance of the SNP by putting forward a credible plan for the whole of the UK with answers to the real challenges that people are facing. In response to whether a request from Mr. Yousaf for a Section 30 order would be declined by Labour, she said, "I would say to SNP voters, I understand their desire for change as a working class kid from Greater Manchester. We feel that need for change and we're frustrated by being held back for generations. We need the same solutions. It's not about breaking away from each other, it's about working together." Pressed further on the issue, she said, "That's not for me to decide whether that would happen or not. We're very clear we want a Labour government and we want Labour MPs. So we're working to win for Labour, and the only way we'll get rid of the Conservatives is by voting for Labour come a general election." And when asked if there were any circumstances in which Labour would allow an independence referendum, she responded, "I don't believe the people in Scotland or across the United Kingdom believe their number one priority is around referendums. I think we're all exhausted with referendums and where that's taken us." An article written by Judith Duffy. The National. On Wednesday, the 19th of April. Opinion. the idea of the monarchy preventing instability in the UK couldn't be more ironic. A column written by Asa Samake Roman. I have a confession to make. I've always found the monarchy captivating. As a child, my obsession with learning English and travelling to the UK was mostly supported by my love for the Spice Girls and all things regal. I still find the pomp and pageantry of the British monarchy mesmerising. It's shiny, it's decadent, it's luxurious. It's like a fairy tale. And I love the drama. It's like a very expensive, taxpayer-funded reality show, and you can't deny that makes the UK unique. I never miss a season of The Crown on Netflix, and I make sure my mum and I watch the new series together when I visit her. Though I don't have the patience for lengthy ceremonies, nor do I recognise half the people and symbols that appear on the screen, royal weddings and other historic events still manage to captivate me and millions of others around the globe. The coronation of King Charles and Queen Camilla in a few weeks will draw the eyes of the world to the United Kingdom once again. And although I won't be spending all day glued to my screen, I'll still take a peek, for the monarchy is deeply entrenched in this nation's history and still enjoys widespread support. As a French citizen, I find this institution exotic. That's the best way to put it. The way the media reveres the monarchy, as if it was compulsory, leaves me astonished. The most glaring example of that was after the passing of Queen Elizabeth last year. Even if I was touched to see people queuing to pay their respects, I mostly found the tone of presenters, journalists, and pretty much every single person who appeared on television sets just a bit too much. To be fair, it wasn't just the British media that followed this tone. A number of French outlets asked me to cover the aftermath of the Queen's death, which I did in part. I was out of the country for the most part. So I worked on my radio report, sent it to the editor who had commissioned it, and I thought I'd fulfilled the brief, a very factual report about how events would unfold after the coffin left Balmoral. But apparently it wasn't emotional enough. They wanted me to show the grief of the people of Scotland after the passing of the Queen. I found this request weird and annoying. You would think that the job of a foreign correspondent would be to report accurately on the country's mood and state of mind at this historic moment, instead of perpetuating a fantasised image of a people paralysed in mourning, sitting in their living rooms sobbing while surrounded by monarchy memorabilia. I mean, sure, these people do exist, and they have every right to feel this deep personal attachment to the institution. But do we have to carry on with this myth that people care that much about queens, kings, princesses, dukes, and all the rest? Despite the fact that most people I conversed with showed respect and sadness upon the Queen's passing, they didn't have an intense fondness for the monarchy. It didn't seem to have a huge presence in their lives. And who could blame them? I cannot help but wonder if it remains a relevant institution in the 21st century. There's no denying that the British monarchy has a huge historic significance, that it means a lot for people in terms of tradition, symbol, and continuity. I completely understand that. The Queen was a symbol of stability during her record-breaking reign, which she conducted dutifully. I don't think it's completely absurd to say that the monarchy can be seen as a unifying force for the nation, providing a sense of identity and continuity in an ever-changing world. I get that many people don't want to throw it out of the window. What I don't understand is the argument that the monarchy protects the country against instability, therefore it's useless to even debate its relevance. Look at countries that elect their heads of state, they say. They're unsatisfied, constantly complaining, and their leaders can't seem to ever be able to govern their people. This argument, coming from the United Kingdom, couldn't be more ironic. Have you seen what the United Kingdom has been like over the past decade? Hardly an exemplar of stability, right? Allow me to remind those who use this argument that in the past year alone, there have been 3 different UK prime ministers, multiple strikes, and the economic landscape is utterly dismal. I struggle to see what the monarchy is shielding this country against. Additionally, the idea that a single individual or family can provide stability for an entire country is outdated and unrealistic. It's true that in France, where we elect our heads of state every 5 years, there are valid criticisms to be addressed about the manner in which we go about things. In a time of democratic crisis in the country, people are re-examining the distribution of power, especially because the president, often nicknamed a Republican monarch, holds extensive powers under the Constitution of the Fifth Republic, and calls for constitutional change are getting stronger. Let's not shy away from discussing institutions and constitutions. Although people may believe such topics are trivial in light of the pressing daily issues, I feel this debate is necessary and should be had because it's about our values and the kind of society we want to live in. So I ask you this. Can a democratic society that values equality, fairness and merit still be represented by an institution where birthright determines one's status and opportunities in life? Isn't the concept of a hereditary monarchy at odds with progressive ideals? Several European countries with monarchies are also grappling with similar questions. In Spain, for instance, there have been calls for a referendum on the future of the monarchy following scandals involving former King Juan Carlos I. More recently, in Belgium, there have been debates about the role of the monarchy, with Deputy Prime Minister Pierre-Yves Derman affirming that he's always been opposed to the monarchy. As we prepare to witness the coronation of King Charles and Queen Camilla, it's essential to engage in open, honest and nuanced discussions like these about the future of the British monarchy. As society evolves, so too must the institutions that represent us, ensuring that they remain relevant and reflective of our collective values and aspirations. A column written by Asa Samake-Roman. The National News on Wednesday, the 19th of April. ScotRail peak fares to be scrapped later this year in cut price pilot. An article written by Hamish Morrison. Peak fares will be scrapped in Scotland later this year as a cut price rail travel trial, the First Minister has announced. In a speech to the Scottish Parliament on Tuesday, Humza Yousaf said ScotRail would not have peak fares between October 2023 and March 2024. He said the move would make public transport more accessible, available and affordable. Mr. Yousaf added, "As an important part of that, I can confirm today that the six-month pilot to remove peak time fares from ScotRail services will start in October of this year. The evidence from this pilot and our wider Fair Fares review will allow us to bring forward further targeted measures from next year onwards to ensure that the cost of transport are more fairly shared." The policy was originally announced by the then Finance Secretary, John Swinney, at the end of last year. He said the trial would cost £15 million and came after a letter from the train drivers' union, ASLEF. The union claimed victory in the announcement, saying it demonstrated the benefit of public ownership. Kevin Lindsay, an organiser with ASLEF Scotland, said, "This announcement is a direct result of rail workers demanding this action be taken when we launched our vision for Scotland's railways. With the cost of living crisis hitting Scots hard, we urge the government to explore every opportunity to accelerate the scrapping of peak fares and make the policy permanent. With ScotRail back in public hands, it's only right that passengers and rail workers see the benefit of public ownership as quickly as possible." In a speech outlining his government's priorities, Mr. Yousaf said he wanted to see an increase in the number of journeys made on foot and on bicycles. He added, "As part of our commitment to active travel, we'll also increase our investment to deliver more places where people can walk, wheel and cycle safely for day-to-day journeys. We'll double the charge point network for electric vehicles to at least 6,000 and increase the number of zero-emission buses on Scotland's roads. And we will deliver six new major vessels to serve Scotland's ferry network." An article written by Hamish Morrison.
From the National, Thursday the 20th of April 2023. From the news section, exclusive, I've never seen anyone change their mind on abortion due to protesters. By Steph Braun, multimedia political journalist. I think the closeness of the protesters to the patients made me most angry. There's only one entrance into the building, so there's no way for people to access the service without having to walk directly in front of these men with their unpleasant banners. Dr. Audrey Brown worked in abortion care for more than 30 years before retiring at the end of last year, and experienced firsthand the upsetting trauma caused by anti-abortion campaigners demonstrating outside Sandyford Sexual Health Clinic in Glasgow. Although the building has never been targeted by the Texas-based 40 Days for Life group, often seen frequenting the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital site with mass prayer vigils, staff and patients had to endure the persistent presence of two men using megaphones, body cameras and offensive signs outside the clinic for many months last year. Staff did not know when they were going to show up, making it difficult to manage and protect patients from intimidation. Brown said they caused a huge amount of disruption, upsetting not only patients attending an abortion consultation, but people seeking other sexual health services and staff. She said, "The style of the protest at Sandyford was very offensive and noisy. It was incredibly disruptive and very upsetting for patients attending the abortion service, but also for patients attending Sandyford for any other aspects of the service, and it did feel quite intimidating for staff as well. The doors of the building are automatic, so whenever anyone approaches the doors open, and patients in the general waiting area could hear the protests. I think people felt upset by it. People who come to an abortion clinic often have not been to one before, so they're already a bit anxious. Unfortunately, abortion is still stigmatised, so if you're then being confronted with people shouting very loudly outside the clinic, that is upsetting and people feel judged. We've always encouraged people if they wish to bring a supporting person with them to do so, and sometimes if the patient is very upset, that supporting person can feel quite angry at what their friend or partner or relative has been exposed to. Abortions are not physically carried out at Sandyford, but patients seeking a termination in the Glasgow area go there for an initial consultation and, if they decide they want to self-manage it at home, medication will be given to them in the clinic rather than them going into a hospital, which they may need to do if they are further in the pregnancy or have health issues. Brown told the National some consultations had to be interrupted due to the noise protesters made outside, which she said was even more frustrating given they so often had no impact on a patient's decision to end their pregnancy. Those who stage an anti-abortion demonstration often claim they are trying to offer help and support to women and encourage them to see the pregnancy through. But Brown said she had never in the 3 decades of working on abortion seen any patient change their mind because of strangers condemning their choice. I imagine one of their aims is to put people off coming to the appointment, but I'm certainly not aware of anybody changing their decision based on what they witnessed outside the clinic, said Brown. If they appeared, then staff would contact people who are shortly due to come to the clinic to say there's something going on outside and give them the opportunity to change their appointment. But most people just say, "I'll ignore them." People at the hospital, like 40 Days for Life, say they're there to provide support and help and counselling, but I cannot imagine if anyone needs support, they're going to speak to a stranger on a pavement. Since the men who were visiting Sandyford took part in a BBC disclosure programme last year, they seem to have cleared off, but there's still nothing to stop them or others with anti-choice views swarming the site again. Meanwhile, sites including the QEUH, Aberdeen Maternity Hospital and the Chalmers Centre in Edinburgh continue to be targeted. Brown said she would be delighted to see buffer zone legislation in place as soon as possible to protect women from harassment. But she did stress she'd like more clarification on what the 150 metre zones, where anti-abortion protesters would be prohibited if legislation passes, will look like, particularly at hospital sites, which spread much further than smaller sexual health clinics. She added she would like to see stronger penalties given to those who flout the law once it is in place, given groups like 40 Days for Life have a lot of money behind them. Brown said, "I'm very supportive of the buffer zone legislation. I think it's very important that people are not harassed and intimidated either going for healthcare or going to their work. It's very clear that NHS does not tolerate harassment of staff or patients on NHS premises. but it seems to me there isn't anything to stop them being harassed just at the entrance. So I think we really need that buffer zone legislation to stop that. I do think we need to be very clear on what 150 metres means, because if it's 150 metres from the door of a building, that might be okay somewhere like Sandyford, but if you had 150 metres from the door of the gynaecology unit at one of the hospitals, it's just going to move it a bit along the road. I think the whole hospital area would have to be protected. We also don't know what would be the consequences if someone was to flout the legislation. I think there needs to be some reasonable sanction for having broken the law. One of my concerns is that a group like 40 Days for Life has got a fair bit of money behind it, and it was something like a major financial penalty for a group that's got a lot of money behind it, that may not be a significant enough disincentive. And that report was by Steph Braun. From the National, Thursday the 20th of April 2023, from the news section, Deposit Return Scheme, Circularity Scotland not informed in advance of delay, by Laura Pollock. The organisation which will run the planned Deposit Return Scheme, DRS, was not informed in advance of the First Minister's decision to delay it. Donald McCalmon, Programme Director for Circularity Scotland, said the delay came because not enough firms are ready to deliver the fantastic consumer experience needed. On Tuesday, Humza Yousaf delayed the introduction of the DRS from this August to March next year. He acknowledged the scheme had led to concern among many in the business community and said the UK's government's decision not to grant an exemption under the Internal Market Act had caused uncertainty. The DRS will mean customers pay a 20p deposit on drinks in cans and bottles, which will be paid back when the containers are returned. On Thursday, McCalmon spoke to the BBC's Good Morning Scotland radio programme. Asked when he found out about the delay, he said it was the same as the time as everybody else on Tuesday. Circularity Scotland is a not-for-profit company set up to administer the scheme and will be responsible for its smooth operation, with BIFA handling logistics. McCalmon stressed the importance of consumers having a simple experience when the DRS launches, saying, "As far as I can understand from what the First Minister has said on Tuesday, not enough organisations are going to be ready to have that fantastic consumer experience. Some of that possibly caused by, as he said, some of the uncertainties that still exist. Uncertainty causes some businesses to say, you know what, maybe I need to start thinking differently about how I'm deploying my resources. That's entirely up to those organisations to take that view." And that report was by Laura Pollock. From the National, Thursday the 20th of April 2023, from the news section, more than 1,300 homeless people died in UK in 2022, say researchers. Report by James Walker. More than 1,300 homeless people died across the UK last year, according to research by a social justice group. The Museum of Homelessness said the figure of 1,313 in 2022 was up by 85% since the work began 4 years ago. The group has been running the Dying Homeless Project since 2019 and said it uses information from coroner's inquiries, media coverage, family testimony and freedom of information requests to verify details of each case. It said the aim is to honour and remember people who would so often be forgotten. According to its research, Scotland recorded a 15% decrease in 2021, with 157 fatalities in 2022. The group said deaths in England rose 22% in 2021 to 875 in 2022, and by 27% in Wales to 76. The number of deaths in Northern Ireland fell by more than a third to 205, but remains almost double the level seen in 2020. Researchers said the true numbers are likely to be higher, as some local authorities have not contributed to the project over the last 2 years. They added that the vast majority of the deaths in 2022 took place after the person was placed in some form of homelessness accommodation rather than when rough sleeping. Museum of Homelessness Director Matt Turtle called for far stronger policy and investment in order to deal with the appalling loss of life. He added, "With a heavy heart, we expect to report more of the same in 2024, but with our colleagues, we will continue to do what we can to save lives." Separately, the project has for the first time obtained figures suggesting the number of deaths that occurred in exempt accommodation, a type of supported housing for residents with specific needs that is exempt from local caps on housing benefits. Of the 12 local authorities who responded to the Museum of Homelessness request for information, Manchester reported 109 deaths in exempt accommodation across 98 properties. This compared to 21 deaths among the rest of the homeless population in Manchester, researchers said. Turtle said, "The fact that so many people continue to die in unregulated, taxpayer-funded accommodation run by rogue landlords is a disgrace." The upcoming Supported Housing Regularity Oversight Bill will provide an urgently needed framework to regulate the rogues, but it's clear local authorities won't have the resources they need to implement it. The government needs to move past piecemeal measures to address both the immediate crisis and the lack of social housing that causes it. In October, a damning report from the Cause Party Levelling Up Housing and Communities Committee warned that the exempt housing system in England is a complete mess that lets down vulnerable residents and rips off taxpayers. It said vulnerable people in need of support are being exploited while providers make excessive profits by capitalising on loopholes. The Museum of Homelessness and frontline groups, including the Simon Community, Streets Kitchen and the Outside Project, are hosting a vigil outside Downing Street on Thursday evening and are encouraging people to light a candle at home and post a picture online with the hashtag #MakeThemCount. The next release by the Office for National Statistics of Homeless Deaths registered in England and Wales in 2022 is due in November. A spokesperson for the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities said its plan to tackle homelessness and rough sleeping includes £186 million to help those with drug and alcohol addiction access recovery services and up to £53 million for suitable and stable accommodation. They added, "Councils have a duty to ensure temporary accommodation is suitable, and we're providing them with £654 million over the 2 years to help prevent homelessness." And that report was by James Walker. From the National, Thursday the 20th of April 2023, from the news section, Cathedral Concert to Aid Warzone Medics, by Lucy Garcia. A former opera singer has organised a Mozart Requiem to raise funds for a charity which provides medical professionals with the skills to work in hostile environments after being inspired by its amazing founder's work. Fiona MacDonald, a trustee of the Wilfred Owen Association and founder of military charity Bravehound, alongside members of Mick Opera, a collective of musicians from the Scottish Opera Orchestra, are to hold the Requiem at 6 p.m. on April the 30th at Glasgow Cathedral, with funds raised going towards the David Nutt Foundation's work in Ukraine. MacDonald says she felt compelled to organise the event as the charity regularly trains and supports surgeons and medical professionals to help people in countries most need of help. "If somebody is willing to literally risk their lives over and over again to train medics to save many lives, how could you not do something to try and help?" said the 59-year-old, who is based just outside Glasgow. "I'm really passionate about the David Nutt Foundation because David Nutt is such an amazing man." MacDonald's role at Bravehound, working with veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, also helped her gauge the importance of the work of the foundation. "PTSD affects people I work with on a daily basis. It means they quite often find relationships break down and can become quite isolated. That's why we provide them with dogs to provide them with 24-hour companionship and encourage them to get out and rejoin the community. And I can see that the effect of this work he does is immense and inspired me to say, what can we do that will make the most impact?" The former opera singer, who has worked for Scottish Opera, Opera North and the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden over a 25-year period, said that when she contacted MacOpera, they immediately said, "Yes, let's do it, we'll come and play." The 30 performers are expected to have a rehearsal in the afternoon of the event and have been given permission to use Glasgow Cathedral free of charge. MacDonald has encouraged people to attend the event in person, if possible, to listen to the most beautiful music, or to donate online. Mozart died before completing his Requiem, leaving that task to others. "It is some of the most beautiful music ever written," she added. "I think that wherever there are horrific things going on in the world, you think, if there is a God, then Mozart's probably the best evidence there might be one, as it just has a way of bringing the people together. Internationally acclaimed tenor soloist Jamie McDougall said that when he was approached, he had no hesitation, as he was previously part of a Mozart concert organised by McOpera and McDonald last year to raise funds for the Red Cross's Ukraine crisis appeal. "I think everyone was very conscious that they wanted to try and do something in support of Ukraine," said the 57-year-old, who lives close to Stirling in central Scotland. "When I was part of the concert last year, I had colleagues who had family caught up in what was happening in Ukraine. Tenor John Dazak has family in Ukraine. They're all musicians. The women managed to get out, but the men who were violinists and pianists were left behind because they stayed to help with the war effort. I couldn't imagine being in that situation and think, I'm just a singer, what can I do? And doing this concert is the least we can do to help keep conversations on the war very much alive." He added that he hopes that the Requiem is watched and listened to by Ukrainians who have travelled from the country to escape the war and now live in Scotland. "I'm hoping we'll get people to come along and show support and enjoy the concert and raise money for the David Knott Foundation. There have been stories of some well-known Ukrainian musicians who have died on the front line, and you think to yourself, we don't know how fortunate we are to be here, and there are people who have lost their lives that you'd never expected to have lost it. I just hope we don't have to do this next year. That is my biggest hope, and that Ukraine will be united again and Russia will be defeated." Ellie Knott, co-founder and chief executive of the David Knott Foundation, said, "To each and every individual taking part or attending this month's performance of the Mozart Requiem at Glasgow Cathedral, we are deeply grateful for your support. Since Russia's brutal invasion began, we have worked hard to support Ukraine's doctors and surgically trained over 200 surgeons and anaesthetists in life-saving surgical skills across the country. Every donation will help us to train even more doctors to help their communities as the war continues to rage on. Thank you." Tickets can be found at eventbrite.com. And that report was by Lucy Garcia.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hear and Review and tell your friends about our service.